call to order the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources. Today is the 4th of May, and we have four public hearings scheduled. We have public hearings scheduled on House Bill 2047, 2400, 2445, and 2474. We are going to take them in that order, so we're going to start out by opening up a public hearing on House Bill 2047. Dan, you want to briefly describe what it does? And I don't have the sign-up sheet yet, but I'm going to guess that maybe Washington County and or Metro want to kick it off. Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2047 makes adjustments to reserve boundaries in comprehensive planning maps adopted by Metro and previously adjusted by the Legislative Assembly. There's no revenue or fiscal impact for this bill.
Okay.
Right.
Must be
visuals.
Must be a land use day.
You have your 3D glasses. Do you want to?
Go ahead. Okay. All we need to do to complicate the land use system is start.
3D, right, LIDAR imagery. Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Randy Tucker. I'm Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro, here today to speak in support of House Bill 2047. House Bill 2047 is simple in concept and detailed in execution. And the concept is that it is merely correcting errors, essentially, in drafting that were embedded in House Bill 4078 last session. House Bill 4078, you may recall, was the so-called land use grand bargain, the one that responded to the Court of Appeals decision overturning the urban and rural reserve decisions in Washington County. And it was ultimately a consensus piece of legislation. And as far as we know, this is also a consensus piece of legislation because it doesn't intend to change any policy decisions that the legislature made last session. It just merely intends to correct mistakes that were made that we can show you briefly when the computer boots up. So beyond that, that's all I have to say about it until we can show you what it is. And except for one more thing, I have the proxy today of Mary Kyle McCurdy and 1,000 Friends of Oregon, who's also supporting this legislation. Mary Kyle testified on the House side but is unable to be here today and said I could go ahead and say on the record that she also supports legislation. So the three of us, Mary Kyle, Jim, and I, were a panel over on the House side, and we're not aware of any opposition. Is that true?
I'm not.
Yeah. Okay. And we've also worked with the Department of Agriculture and DLCD to make sure this bill is technically correct. So with that, I'll let Jim.
For the record, Jim McCauley, representing Washington County. I don't have anything background-wise to add with this other than to say that the process for developing this bill did include several different organizations who were at the physical table when the rural and urban reserves mapping process was undertaken during the 14th session. And again, what's in front of you, at least on the screen anyway, is a visual representation of the actual narrative in the bill. Before this was submitted, we worked with our collective agencies to make sure that every change that is being sought in this process was mechanical in nature and was tied to the actual spirit of went through the process in 2014 with House Bill 4078. And it's a series of islands that got the wrong call, or a road here and there, or a piece of property that was isolated in terms of a tax lot as well. And that's essentially the only changes that are in front of you. And it went through the House process without any objection whatsoever. And we're here basically just to complete the process. So the first picture that you've got here in front of you essentially is, so this is Cordon Road again. You got an area where a road wasn't designated correctly. Color essentially just needs to change to make sure what's on the left side is the same on the same through the center, so you don't end up any kind of an unintended consequence. Here you've got a tax lot at an intersection. Again, narrative didn't physically match up with what is supposed to be the same color. And again, same type of situation here. This is a physical change to a rural reserve. And
this is the one where the number of the lot that was written into the bill was incorrect, and so it was intended to be this little piece. The little piece on the bottom left changed undesignated and instead accidentally named this large lot up here. So this is just changing the, it had to do with the section township range designation of the parcel. And so that was just a mistake that's being corrected so that this little piece over here on the left becomes undesignated and this goes back to rural reserve.
Again, similar type of issue. You've got a tax lot here right along the northwestern side of Cornelius Pass. Again, it needs to have a physical change so it matches up which is on both sides so you don't, again, run into issues in terms of the planning process.
So are these, so you said changes to the colors on the maps. So are the maps referenced? In the statute?
Yeah, so Chair Edwards, what you've got physically in statute is a narrative. A legal description spelled out, and you'd have to be a map writer actually to walk yourself through it, but that's why we included our planning shop from the county as well as Metro in this process to make sure that the alignment and the physical narrative matches up with whether it's a rural reserve, urban reserve, or undesignated.
So these maps that we're showing you are basically the visual representations of the words in the bill.
Okay. Thank you.
So another one here at the intersection. And then there's one last one. This large lot should be which color? Blue.
It all needs to go to blue, yeah.
Yeah.
As well as the road.
Yeah.
So part, I mean, it's difficult.
You can see what the mistakes are at any rate. So.
And I think part of this is again, it comes down, I mean, the complexity of the land use system that we have in the state, but again, trying to get what physically is intent matched up with what's physically in a narrative as far as statute is usually where the error occurs. And again, worked with all the parties who were at the table during the development of 4078, which went through in 14. This was a mapping error fix bill, and it's nothing more detailed than that.
Mm-hmm. I might add one point. There were some people that came forward asking for changes that were actual policy changes that were not part of what was adopted in House Bill 4078. And those may or may not be meritorious, but this bill is intended merely to correct mistakes, and those kinds of things where there is a policy question that has been raised are not part of this bill and have been excluded. And I believe the relating clause also keeps them out.
It's pretty narrow.
Yeah, exactly. So this is really purely technical and, as far as we know, uncontroversial.
Yeah, okay. How long did it take before people, after the passage of the bill last session, it was the short session, how long before people realized, oh, man, we got this number wrong? I mean, was it while we were still in, but just like we couldn't address it then?
And yes, yeah. Mr. Chair, I believe there was some things got raised almost immediately, but it was just, you know, nearing the end of the short session and wasn't possible to address.
Okay. Questions, colleagues of our panelists? Doesn't look like there are any questions. Thank you both.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We also have signed up on this bill, Joseph Auth. And anybody else that would like to speak to this bill in the public hearing, feel free to come on forward now. This is all that we have signed up on it. So go ahead.
Hi. My name is Joseph Off. I live at 325 Northwest 34th Avenue, Hillsboro, Oregon, 97124. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony on House Bill 2047. We understand House Bill 2047 does not change any of the actions of House Bill 4078, but we appreciate the opportunity to speak since we were not given an opportunity through the House Bill 4078 process. The rural residents and farms on Northwest 34th Avenue, 336th Avenue, 338th Avenue, and Iona Court, north of Tualatin Valley Highway, were added into the urban growth boundary through House Bill 4078 in the 2014 legislature. This area was not considered for the urban growth boundary expansion in 2011. House Bill 4078 in the 2014 legislature session violates the statewide planning goal number one, which is Oregon Administrative Rule 660-15-000, to develop a citizen involvement program that ensures the opportunity for citizens to be involved in all phases of the planning process by not including the public and so it violated this goal by not including the public in the entire process. It also violates the Fifth Amendment to our U.S. Constitution, nor be deprived of liberty, life, liberty, or property without due process of law by skipping the typical public process Metro does when a land is being considered to be placed into the urban growth boundary. Even though these rural residents and farms will not be removed from the urban growth boundary through House Bill 2047, I want to share some items not considered during the House Bill 4078 process and how this bill skipped over our public process. Washington County said that they are not required to directly notify landowners when considering land for urban and rural reserves designations, since urban and rural reserves are planning designations that have no financial impact to landowners. It would be good, or it would be great for the legislature to make it a requirement for local and regional governments to contact potentially affected landowners by postal mail when a local government or a regional government is conducting a rural or urban reserve designation public process. Washington County's website says that urban reserve does not guarantee the urban growth boundary will expand there. And we were told a lot that that's just because we're urban reserve, it's automatically guaranteed that the UGB will be expanded there since we found out back in May. Title 14 of Metro Code required notification directly to landowners and surrounding landowners within 1 mile, 20 days in advance notice of the first public hearing on proposed urban growth boundary expansion, with materials showing how this bill, how this will affect landowner. Urban growth boundary expansion is a different public process than urban reserves, since urban growth boundary expansion has potential livelihood and financial impacts. And this is just a it's in the online, but it's a copy of the postcard that we received, and it shows that our land was not considered in 2011 to be placed in the urban growth boundary, but this is the typical notification we received by mail, and House Bill 4078 didn't do that at all for us. City of Cornelius did not request the rural residents and farms on Northwest 334th, 336th, 338th Avenues, and 9 to be placed in the urban growth boundary in 2011. A meeting occurred on February 23rd, 2014 to discuss House Bill 4078. None of the affected landowners of Dairy Creek West were notified of the meeting. The meeting had no attendance sheets and no meeting minutes. What we heard from people who attended the meeting, it was side conversations that occurred in meeting with local officials, state officials, developers, and special interest organizations, where they were, it appears from what I hear from the conversation, they were making trade deals on the side. When the landowners in Dairy Creek West asked who requested their land to be placed into the urban growth boundary, they received two different answers. Their former state legislator said the City of Cornelius requested the land to be placed into the urban growth boundary, and then we heard from the Cornelius city manager, where he said that the state legislature placed Dairy Creek West into the urban growth boundary, and the city had no input on the matter. Placing land into the urban growth boundary causes the county to change rural zoning to urban holding zoning, which prevents further expansion of rural uses. This wasn't considered when the bill was passed. This change of zoning impacts people's livelihood and farm referral. Residents of Dairy Creek West run the risk we were able to keep we're lucky to keep our rural zoning, but if we got put in this urban zoning, we weren't allowed to continue having certain livestock underneath the urban holding zoning. The next number eight is the next stage after the change in zoning, and is annexation, which affects landowners by increasing property taxes, utility rates, insurance costs, and other financial impacts that was not considered. The landowners of Dairy Creek West have stated that they do not want their land to be in the urban growth boundary, and this was we were very active back in 1994, and then we also have the 2014 petition that we also submitted online, and we also have a petition from MoveOn.org from people who don't live in our area but is in support of us. And the last thing I want to add was that the Dairy Creek West would not have snuck into the urban growth boundary through House Bill 4078 if the landowners of Dairy Creek West were a rich, famous, an elected official or related to elected official. Right now, the UGB line cuts through our neighborhood as a squiggly line to match the 100-year floodplain. We asked if we could make the line a road, make the line to be a road or railroad tracks to afford confusion to the landowners who are, especially the farmers. And we were told the line has to be a soft line, a natural barrier, instead of a hard line, such as a road and railroad tracks. But when we're looking down at the south side, there's the UGB line basically cuts around this one individual's property who is a relative of an elected official who the boundary is at Northwest 345th Avenue, the railroad tracks, and their tax lot. And so it completely avoids that person's property. So there's not... there's obviously not a fair, and there's a fairness issue there. But again, thank you for an opportunity to speak today, because we just didn't get an opportunity to speak before. Thank you.
Thank you, Joseph. So you did not testify in February on House Bill 4078.
I didn't know about it.
Okay.
I forgot to mention that, like, they had that meeting on a Sunday on February 23rd, and then I think they engrossed the bill on February 27th. They put something, I think, in the Oregonian. When I went back and did research, they put something, I guess, in the Oregonian on the 25th, but it was like a zoomed-out map of Washington County where you couldn't see whose property is affected. But that was pretty much the notice that they gave to the public back then, but we weren't aware about it until May.
Got it. Thank you for your testimony. Yeah. Questions? Senator Olson.
Reading your testimony, I just want to make clear, you are opposed to this bill.
the bill right now is it's a cleaning bill, making technical corrections. At this point, I'm just saying I'm neutral just because there's this bill doesn't affect our land at all, where it's doing the cleaning and our neighborhood's land. So right now, neutral. Opposing it wouldn't really do anything for our neighborhood.
Follow up?
Right, yeah.
So then, to back this up then a little bit, you were not in favor of the other bill, 457.
Correct.
Or 4078, I should say.
Yes.
Because that brought in properties that you didn't think should be brought into the urban growth boundary.
Correct. It brought in my neighbors and I. We were brought into the urban growth boundary, and A, we didn't support being brought into the urban growth boundary, and B, we were upset that we didn't have our public process that. That people normally do in the metro area to provide input whether they want their land in or out of the urban growth boundary.
Thank you.
All right. Other questions? Thank you for your testimony and bringing the concerns about not so much this bill, but the underlying issue. I appreciate hearing from you.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks. Okay, does anybody else want to testify on House Bill 2047? Nobody? Okay, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2047, and we're going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2400. And Dan, if you could tell us a little bit about what the bill does while we await the Water Resources Department to kick off the bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2400A provides that submission of certain task force reports prior to specified dates in 2015 satisfies the requirement to submit reports by July 1st of 2014. The bill also extends the deadline for the effective date of a Water Resources Commission rule establishing methodology for determining seasonally varying stream flows and makes varying flow requirements applicable to certain projects. There's no revenue or fiscal impact for this bill.
All right. Raquel?
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, for the record, Raquel Ransier, Senior Policy Coordinator with the Oregon Water Resources Department. I'm here today to provide testimony in support of House Bill 2400A. House Bill 2400A makes a few adjustments to a bill that was passed in 2013, Senate Bill 839, which established a water supply development account to provide funding for water supply development projects that provide environmental, social, and economic benefits. There were two, there's basically two components to House Bill 2400. The first one deals with timelines. Senate Bill 839 required two task forces to be convened and to deliver their reports to the legislature. And these task forces were not convened in time to meet the legislative deadlines. In addition, as a result, the rulemaking timelines have not been met. Despite this, stakeholders as well as the department have continued to work diligently to get this program on the ground. We understand the importance of it to Oregonians and would like to continue to work towards implementation. We expect that the rules will be adopted actually coming this summer. We have it before our commission in June. So House Bill 2400 adjusts the timelines to align with the implementation of the program. In addition, there's one other change that is to the Senate Bill 839 program, which is to seasonally varying flows. So seasonally varying flows are flows that must be left in stream outside of the irrigation season in order to meet and protect the watershed functions that are outlined in the original statute. And basically what we found is that during the task force meetings that the original statutory language talks about new permits. And so you could have a new project that receives a permit before it comes in for funding, and that would not trigger the seasonally varying flow requirement, even though that project had never been built. So essentially what we found is that it could set up the scenario where you have projects that go and get their water rights permit in advance in order to avoid the seasonally varying flow requirement that they protect the watershed functions outside of the irrigation season. So this seeks to close that loophole by making the seasonally varying flow requirement apply to projects that are funded from Senate Bill 839, regardless of when they receive their water right permit. So those are the changes that you'll see in the bill. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Yeah, Senator Thompson.
Thank you. Chair Edwards. So if this bill doesn't pass, does the process just go forward and we live with 839?
Chair Edwards, Senator Thompson, if the bill doesn't pass, the one piece that would be a challenge for us would be the existing permits that are out there that would like to get funding from 839 and what to do with those. Do we allow them to get funding? Folks have suggested to us that we not allow them to get funding. Other folks have suggested that then they would be able to, and obviously that would create a challenge because we'd have projects that wouldn't be getting the seasonally varying flows as intended by the legislature when they passed the bill.
Yeah, Senator Olson.
Adams, it looked like Senator Thompson might have had a follow-up. Hmm.
I'm sure you're asking this question, Senator.
Could be, but maybe not.
Guessing.
Senate Bill 839 puts specific requirements on the legislative body and on the task force. Why weren't those requirements met?
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, I presume that you are speaking to the timelines?
The timelines, right.
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, the timelines weren't met because the task forces weren't convened in time.
Follow-up.
Yeah.
Why?
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, the department was not the one that appointed the task forces. The task forces were appointed by the governor's office.
Follow-up?
Yeah.
My understanding is that the subgroups were appointed, but the task force itself was not convened. Is that correct?
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, All of the work to date, I believe, has been done. I don't foresee us needing to reconvene the task forces at this point in time. The subgroups, they met the statutory deadline of February 1st. And then the seasonally varying flows task force and the governance task force submitted their task force reports to the legislature early this year.
Would early this year be prior to January 1st, 2015?
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson. Sorry, I had to think through the dates
question.
There. I believe that the seasonally varying flows task force report was submitted on January 30th, and the governance task force, we were intending to submit it on January 30th as well. However, we became aware of an issue that made us want to reconvene the task forces or the governance task force. So that task force report was delivered to the legislature, I believe, March 31st.
My concern is this, is that we put out an edict, we put out a bill, the governor signs it, says we are going to do this at this time frame. And we don't do it at this time frame. And so people in their normal course of work go ahead and plan, and they plan to do a water project, and they get their permit. And suddenly we come in with a bill and file it retroactively and saying, oh, by the way, this is what we're going to back up to because we didn't get our work done to clarify and clean up a mess basically you've caused yourself, to be frank about it. And now you've got these people that you don't want to fund because they have a permit and it's not predicated on seasonally varying flows. So you've caused them distress also. The question then is since you did not get your work done on time, not you personally, but your task force did not get your work done on time, why do those people that already hold permits, why should they be vilified because they did things correctly and the task force didn't, if you will?
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, I see the timelines as being a separate piece from the closing that loophole on the existing permits. So, for example, on that the loophole piece is dealing with you could have a water right permit that was issued 5 years ago before the bill was passed. You could have a water right permit that is issued today. Either one of those scenarios, those would still be considered an existing permit. So the seasonally varying flow would not apply in that case without this bill. I see that as separate from then the task force deadlines and the rulemaking deadlines, because they're I guess I see them as two separate issues. I don't know if I've adequately answered your question.
Well, I kind of equate this to our contractual agreements with PERS. You've got a contract when you give a person a permit to use water. And now you want to retroactively go back and change that contract and say you must also use seasonally varying flows in this contract, which wasn't part of the original contract. I guess that's my concern.
And Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, I do want to be clear that this applies only to a project that is not that would like to receive funding from Senate Bill 839. So ultimately, it's their choice. If they don't want to receive funding from Senate Bill 839, the seasonally varying flow requirement would not apply. This is only for projects that meet the requirements in the bill that are storage projects that would like funding from Senate Bill 839.
Follow up on that one. So we've given them a permit predicated on Senate Bill 839. And we realize that we've messed up. We didn't get our reports done. We didn't get our work done. And now we're going to go back and say, oh, by the way, if you want funding from Senate Bill 839, which is why they used it in the first place, now you have to change to meet, you want us to pass a law, so they have to change to meet the requirement of seasonally varying flows, which they didn't have to do in the original 839. Is that correct?
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, so when a water right permit is issued, for example, let's say it was a water right permit that was issued before Senate Bill 839 was even introduced in 2013. This bill would address those permits that come in and say they'd like funding. In addition, it would address permits that are issued during the part that the legislature was talking about, 839 in 2013. And it would also address permits that come in the door, you know, let's say 6 months from now, and they get their permit first, and then they come and apply for 839 funding. So what we're seeing here is that basically if we issue the permit, as this language, the current statutory language is that it's considered an existing permit. It's not a new permit that we can condition the seasonally varying flow for. I don't think that's changing the rules in the middle of the game, because basically if they'd like funding from the program, they're going to be coming and asking for it. And we haven't issued any grants or loans, so nobody's gone through and had a permit conditioned or not conditioned as a result of Senate Bill 839 to date.
So I have a clarifying question just to make sure that I understand this. So 839 established this program, and seasonally varying flows is a part of that, but you were waiting, excuse me, you couldn't write, am I understanding correctly, that you couldn't write the rules on the rules governing the seasonally varying flows until you were done with the task force work?
Chair Edwards, that's correct.
Okay, and so you're delayed in the task force work for whatever reason. In the meantime, there have been some folks that have applied for the permits, and you are now approaching us saying, well, we've got this body of folks that have applied or received permits, but have not received funding. And you want some clarification that they would be, that A, you can continue your work, and B, they can't get, that those seasonally varying flows conditions do in fact apply to those projects and those permits. Because there's a question.
Chair Edwards, I think that what we're saying is that if this bill doesn't pass, House Bill 2400 doesn't pass, then with a permit that's already been issued, and these permits, like I said, they could be before 2013, so before Senate Bill 839 was passed, they could be from 2013 or post Senate Bill 839 passage. If this bill doesn't pass, then basically anybody that has a water right permit, we don't have the authority to condition that permit for seasonally varying flows. So what you could do then is you could go apply for your permit. Let's say you apply for your permit in 2015, you get your permit in 2016, and you apply for funding from Senate Bill 839 in 2017. Under that scenario, we would not, you know, the Senate Bill 839 program exists, but we wouldn't be able to condition that permit for a seasonally varying flow. Does that help clarify?
Yeah, it does. It does help clarify for me. And I guess my other question, and I will ask folks that want to testify after you, whether or not there were a lot of people that were at the table negotiating on Senate Bill 839, and then there were some people that were still opposed. And I would understand if folks that were opposed to the original 839 were against this bill, I would understand that. I'm particularly interested if the parties that negotiated and all got to yes on Senate Bill 839 are in favor of this bill. And I'm not asking you to characterize their support to the extent that you're not authorized to, but I'm putting that out there for people that come up after you to testify on the bill.
Hey, Chair Edwards, I'll note that we did run these recommendations through the governance task force, which had a broad variety of stakeholders involved. So I don't know if that's helpful in knowing that.
Yeah, thank you. Senator Thompson.
Could you explain seasonal and variable flows? How would somebody fill up their reservoir? And if it gets empty during the year, how would they, what's the criteria to meet on seasonal and variable flows in order to fill up these reservoirs?
Chair Edwards, Senator Thompson, so seasonally varying flows are the flows that are outside of the irrigation season that are necessary in order to protect certain functions, basically watershed functions. And one of the task forces went through the process of fleshing that out a little bit more. And we currently have that out for public comment for the rulemaking. And so basically, it's the flows that you, before you divert, that you need to leave in stream. And that'll be based on basically the ecological functions for that particular watershed. That'll determine what that actual kind of flow prescription is that needs to be left in stream.
Yeah, follow.
So we don't even know what that is yet?
Chair Edwards, Senator Thompson, I'd be happy to get back to you with what the requirements are that have been proposed. I don't have those with me today. But for each individual stream, it will be based on, you know, that particular stream's watershed functions that are determined to need to be protected.
Yeah. So that's still in rules and not determined yet?
Chair Edwards, Senator Thompson, the guidelines are in rule of what the technical team that develops this flow prescription would need to consider to in order to make that determination. And those rules have not yet been adopted. They're up for public comment.
So when do you see that being done? If somebody wanted to build a reservoir and get this money, get these grant dollars or whatever to do this, when would that process be ready?
Chair Edwards, Senator Thompson, you know, I don't recall how long it would take. Basically, they would need to look at what data that we have available. And then based on that, that would determine how much more data needs to be collected in order to determine then what flows need to be protected.
Follow up? I think that's what that means. You're thinking.
So we're basing whether you could build a reservoir and get grant dollars to do it on some kind of formula that nobody knows about yet? Or so do they come to the Water Resource Department and say, what's a seasonal variable flow? When can I put water in my reservoir? What's the certainty of being able to put any water in a reservoir if they go to the expense of building this thing?
Chair Edwards, Senator Thompson, I'd be happy to follow up with you with the – I'm not as versed in
the
details.
Record.
Chair Edwards, Senator Thompson, I'm not as well versed on the seasonally varying flows specifics, but I'd be happy to follow up with you. There is a copy of the seasonally varying flows task force that we provided to legislators. I can get you a copy of that, and we'd be certainly happy to follow up with you on the specifics. I think the what you're getting at is that so there's the permitting process, and then there's basically, if you want to receive public dollars, there's some additional requirements that are put in place, and one of that is the seasonally varying flow. So we have our permitting requirements. You may be able to get water available from that, but you may need to do some additional protections if you'd like to get funding from the grant program, grant and loan program.
Thank you for the. Any more questions?
No, all of that was crystal clear.
Well, and Senator, if you want to get some clarifications on the record, we can have them come back and answer questions.
Yeah,
I think it would be good to
the expert is on get, seasonal variable flows. I'd like to hear it.
Yeah, I think it'd be good to get specific questions so they can, you know, do the research, come back. I mean, this was a highly negotiated bill that you carried last session. We only had one no in the Senate, and it was unanimous in the House, and it's because a lot of people worked really hard on it. But I think that there's some potentially since then and now, maybe some things have come up, and you know, we need some clarification. So I think the committee would appreciate that. And so Any other questions for the department?
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to make a comment. My concern is the retroactivity, the fact that you didn't get your work done, or somebody, some task force didn't get their work done when they were supposed to. And that concerns me that we can pass a bill to fix something that you should have done in the first place, and that's my concern.
I hear your concern, and if money had been given out and there were shovels were digging in the ground and stuff like that, then I mean that would be one thing. Getting the permit, and I don't know. Well, maybe you could comment on how much expense is involved in getting. You said there are folks that could have permits, but that is one issue, and then the money is another issue, and that's where we get into the seasonally varying flows part.
And I think another point is, with the changing climate or whatever, the drier period, just for farm and crop growing and all kind of stuff, we really need to look at storage and reservoirs, and we're way behind that in the state, and then we've lost another year because mm-hmm. of this process. So it's a lot of that too.
So if next time you come back, if you could speak to costs and when costs are incurred along this, because I think that gets a bit to the retroactivity aspect of it. So,
Chair Edwards, I'll follow up with you. I'm not sure that I understand your question about costs.
Okay. We can talk about it offline, and then we'll come back. We will have another opportunity for some comment before we take the bill up in for a vote. So, okay, thanks.
All right. Thank you.
Let's see. Next up on this bill, April Snell and Angela Crowley Cook. And nobody else has signed up, but if in lieu of or in light of the testimony, if anybody else would like to come speak to the bill, I'll give you an opportunity after these two folks.
Good afternoon. Chair Edwards, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, April Snell with the Oregon Water Resources Congress. We represent the irrigation districts and other agricultural water suppliers around the state. And we were proponents of the original bill and members of both the Seasonally Varying Flow Task Force and the Governance Task Force. And we remain supportive of House Bill 2400 in its current amended fashion. And I am also here on behalf of the Oregon Association of Nurseries, who have submitted written testimony that hopefully you have received, and also here on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon and the League of Oregon Cities, who are also supportive of this bill. And just as a little bit of background in listening to the very interesting questions that the committee has had about this, Senate Bill 839 was passed in 2013, and it could be described as political sausage making as its finest. There was a lot of efforts that went into it and a lot of good thinking, and perhaps the words that ended up on the paper are not necessarily the words that we all would have liked to be there. But contained within that original bill is a provision that talks about how storage projects, because those are the only projects that are subject to seasonally varying flows, that projects who want to come to this fund and seek grant or loan funding, that if they already had a water permit issued, that permit would need to be conditioned with these seasonally varying flows, which are these wintertime flows that are needed for fish. That was in the original bill. However, in the process of going through the task force work, the department received legal advice that they did not have the authority to place those conditions upon a permit once it's already been issued. So the issues in 2400 are kind of separate. The deadlines are because for whatever reason, we did not get appointed to the task force until August of last year, and then we spent over 6 months slogging through things that if you want to know, I can tell you and put you to sleep very easily or entertain you, I'm not sure which. But we put in a lot of effort in those task force, and I'm of the opinion that deadlines are fairly arbitrary as long as the work is done and the work is done well. And I feel that now that we're in the rulemaking phase, we've reached that point, and now we can hopefully move forward to see the program be implemented. But this issue of the permit conditions is something that was contained in the original bill, but it didn't have the right language for the department to legally be able to apply those conditions to those projects. And it would only apply to projects who would be seeking funding under 839 and would be subject to the seasonally varying flow requirements, which have a kind of a three-pronged test to them. And I will also say, as representative of folks who are very eager to use this fund, we want to see it up and running, and we want to see it workable. And undoubtedly, there's going to be more work to come. There will be things that come up that we didn't think of, and we're going to have to come back and tweak those a little bit. But we want to see this up and running, and because we're facing a drought this summer that will unlikely be the driest on record for most all parts of the state, we see storage as being a very important component. However, in order to have storage in today's modern age, we need to make sure that we're being mindful and protective of the environmental needs in the for the fish in the streams when they need it most. However, we also want to make sure that folks that are not seeking grant or loan funds from this program are not subject to the requirements that are put forth, which would include the seasonally varying flows. However, projects that are not funded through 839 are storage projects, are still subject to flow requirements, but they're called peak and ecological flow requirements. My folks don't like those very much. And the reason being is because they're often set in a black box with little understanding of how they're made and no ability to refute them. The seasonally varying flows in concept is supposed to be something that puts more transparency into how those flows are determined and gives the applicants a rebuttable presumption so that if they don't like the information that they receive, they can challenge that. There's also a provision there that would allow for the state to invest in determining what fish need when they need it and where they need it in places where there are storage projects of interest, which would benefit not only folks who want to store water, but the state as the whole, because then we can make sure that we're balancing all the needs for the diverse water needs we have in this state. So the bill has a variety of what I would call technical fixes, but the real meat is in getting the grant and loan fund envisioned under Senate Bill 839 up and running. And as Raquel mentioned, the rules are out now for public comment. Those will go to the commission hopefully this summer. And once they're implemented, that program can get up and running and hopefully be putting lots of good projects on the ground, storage, conservation, and efficiency to meet the very, very serious water needs we have of this state. So thank you very much for your time. Be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you for that perspective and explanation. Go ahead.
Angela Crowley Cook, Oregon Environmental Council. April did such an excellent job. I'm not really sure I have a lot to add to that, other than OEC also supports 2400, HB 2400, because it really does clarify things and fix the 839 fund to match the intent of what was originally proposed back in 2013. So thank you. Happy to answer questions.
Thank you both. Questions? April.
Thank you very much. I was around when 839 was around. The question is, why did it take so long to get the task force up and running? And then once it was, I know the subgroups were running ahead of the task force. Once it was, why couldn't you get any work done?
Chair Edwards, Vice Chair Olson, thank you for the question. I'm not really sure about the delay in the initial appointment of the task force. As Raquel mentioned, that was the governor's office, and that governor is no longer around for us to ask. But once we started meeting in August, I'll explain it more frankly, since I am not beholden to an agency in that regard, is you have just about every water interest you can imagine around the table. And when you do that, surprise, we don't all get along. And sometimes it takes several meetings just for us to have a common vernacular or even be able to agree on what a particular term is. And I'm not making that up. We literally spent at least two meetings arguing over what a particular term meant and how that was interpreted differently by different people. And it took a lot of time, and it took a lot more time than was intended, particularly with the seasonally varying flows. And it's a very complex topic that is both a mix of science and policy. And I think, you know, we did the best we could, but there was a lot of issues to work out. And as I mentioned, there probably will be more to come. But I think it's simply the nature of when you have a large, diverse group of interests who typically don't get along on very many things, except we all like water, it's going to take some time to come to an agreement. And I will add that specifically, the task forces that were set up in Senate Bill 839, the seasonally varying flow task force specifically had a decision-making determined by consensus, with consensus being defined as, I believe it was no more than two people opposing or no more than one opposing. And in the end, we actually were able to complete that task force's work with, I believe, two. We did it by thumbs, so there were some that were in between, but there were actually no votes at the end of that work. And so that type of decision-making is not one that is known for its brevity.
Follow up?
Yeah.
The subgroups were, in my understanding, correct me if I'm incorrect, there were three people on the subgroup, on each subgroup of the two subgroups we had?
I think
according
that's,
to 839, it was the makeup.
Yeah, I didn't serve on the subgroups, but I know there was the science subtask group and the economic subgroup, and I want to say there was three or four folks on each of those. And I didn't attend any of those meetings, but I did read their report, and then a member of each of those was also on the larger group.
Okay, follow up there. Yeah. My question is then, how did the subgroups, they were given a definitive problem to solve, but was that given to them by 839, or was that given to them by the task force that wasn't around?
Chair Edwards, Vice Chair Olson, I'm not sure what direction the subgroup was given specifically, except that I know they tried to interpret their task as set forth in the bill, which, in referencing my previous comment, sausage making. So it may not have been exactly clear to them. I think the seasonally varying flow subgroup was more defined as opposed to the economic subgroup, but I think those members did the best they could and came up with a report for us to use later in the process.
All right. One last question, if you don't mind. And you were absolutely correct. I'm looking at it here. We had one for the SVF, if you will, and the other one was for financial feasibility. So those two subgroups were out working, and then they came back to the larger task force when they were done with their work. So this larger task force is still alive, and if it is, when will the final report be issued? Is that what this is about?
Chair Edwards, Vice Chair Olson, both of the task forces have completed their work, and there have been reports on both of those groups already issued. I believe the seasonally varying flow task force came early this year, and the governance task force came a couple months later due to the issues previously mentioned. So those task forces have concluded their work, and then there were members on both of those task forces who then were part of the Rules Advisory Committee that came up with the draft rules that are now out for public comment.
Okay, thank you.
All right, any other questions for this panel?
I think we've grilled them enough.
Thank you both. Would anybody else like to testify on this particular bill? Nobody else has signed up. Okay, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2400. And next up, we're going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2445A. Lisa, you want to come forward, and Dan, tell us briefly what we're doing here?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2445A authorizes the Director of Agriculture and the State Department of Agriculture to provide notice of quarantine areas by newspaper and one or more additional methods. It also makes a number of other changes, including those relating to grade B milk, the eastern filbert blight, and the defunct Interstate Compact on Pest Control. This bill has no revenue or fiscal impact.
Right. Good afternoon, Chair Edwards, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director with the Department of Agriculture. In front of you in House Bill 245A, is an agency cleanup bill, and it touches many different programs throughout the Department of Agriculture, but there are some significant issues that are addressed in it. In two areas, we deal with the notification around our quarantine statutes. Previously, the law required us to provide notice in a paper of general circulation, typically the Oregonian. We have done some work and believe there are additional ways which are more effective in terms of touching the public and making those people who are affected by quarantines known. And so we had proposed to make notice in two different ways, subject to what was needed to be done. There was some concern in the House committee that there still needed to be notification through a newspaper, especially in some of the smaller communities. And so the bill was amended to allow for notification in a paper of general circulation within the quarantine area. So it's really trying to target that notification for the people who are impacted. In addition, the bill cleans up our plant pest and disease statutes. It provides some definition changes around infected and infested throughout for form and consistency. It also repeals the grade B milk standards. Some years ago, the industry moved towards grade A fluid milk, and the B standards are no longer necessary, and so we're proposing to just have them removed from the statutes. In addition, the bill deletes the sections that were put in place initially to implement the renewable fuel standards and the dates and volume thresholds have been met and have passed, and so we're suggesting to just clean that out of the statutes and bring them up to date with today. And then finally, it deletes the Interstate Pest Shippers Compact that was dissolved in 2013, and that was a national program through the National State Departments of Agriculture. So with that, I will stop there and see if there are any questions.
Could you repeat the section about the renewable fuel standards again?
Sure. So there were implementing statutes initially back in 2007-ish with thresholds that had to be met for ethanol as well as biodiesel. This just removes those initial thresholds and those dates that have passed some years ago and brings the statute up to date with what's currently going on.
Okay. So nothing about this bill repeals such programs, right?
That would be correct. Nothing repeals the programs. The programs stay as is today. It just gets rid of those initial
limitations. I'm pretty sure we'd have more people here in the hearing room if it did, but you know, you never know.
Sometimes there goes Olson's support.
Sneak
I was
through,
hoping he would vote for this.
Can you get an amendment in there? You're paranoid.
Just saying. Yeah, move this on its way as fast as possible. I was joking around. Any other questions for? Okay.
Great. Thank you.
Is there anybody else that would like to testify? Nobody else has signed up on House Bill 2445A. Anybody else? Okay. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2445A. And we're going to open up our final public hearing of the day, a public hearing on House Bill 2474A. Dan, if you tell us what we're doing, and is Lori? Go ahead. You can kick us off here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2474A prohibits veterinary facilities from offering services related to the practice of veterinary medicine, surgery, or dentistry unless that veterinary facility registers with the Oregon State Veterinary Medical Examining Board and designates a licensed veterinarian to ensure facility is in compliance with rules adopted by the board. It authorizes the board to inspect facilities and requires the board to convene an advisory committee to assist in adopting, repealing, or amending certain rules. There's no revenue impact for this bill, and there's a fiscal impact statement available on OLIS.
Go ahead.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Lori Mockinen, Director of the Oregon Veterinary Board. Mr. Chair and members, this bill, 2474, does two things. First, it opens up ownership options for veterinary practices to individuals who are not licensed. Currently, the rule requires that only a licensed veterinarian can own a veterinary facility. And over the years, we've seen that this is both unenforceable and not particularly fair. A lot of practices are owned by, co-owned by the veterinarian and a spouse. And if we followed the letter of the rule, we would be in the business of evicting widows and orphans after the veterinarian leaves the practice for whatever reason. So we need to fix that. We also have no authority over a number of practices that are owned by out-of-state or international corporations. So we think that this will give both a lot of opportunity for investment in practices to people that have previously not had that opportunity. The other thing this does is it retains the board's ability to regulate veterinary facilities for compliance with the minimum standards of the Practice Act by establishing a facility manager for each practice. That's pretty much all I can think of at the moment. I'd love to answer your questions.
Questions? How would what this does compare to ownerships, the legal framework that other professions have, let's say, like, you know, a medical practice or a, you know, a
right.
dentist
Chair,
or
Chair
a,
Edwards, this is
like
this rule would bring veterinary practices pretty much on a par with other health practices. Currently, a medical practice or a dental practice can be owned, co-owned, or owned wholly by a non-licensee. It also would bring Oregon in line with most of the rest of the country that currently registers facilities.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification. Yeah, Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Chair Edwards. What's this going to cost veterinarians to do this new service?
Chair Edwards, Senator Thompson, we're proposing to charge a registration fee of $150 per year.
Thank you.
Okay.
Chair Edwards.
Yeah.
Will this bill make certain that if a veterinarian retires and his wife keeps the business going, that there will be a resident veterinarian that would oversee all medical practices?
Chair Edwards, Vice Chair Olson, that's precisely what this bill does. It establishes as a condition of operating as a facility that each facility designate a practice or a facility manager who would be responsible for ensuring that minimum standards are met.
Follow up?
Yeah.
But when you said facility manager, I didn't hear the word veterinarian in there. Do they have to be a veterinarian?
It has to be a licensed Oregon veterinarian.
Thank
as
you very much.
In charge of the.
Thank you, Chair.
Great. Okay. Any other questions? Thanks, Lori.
Thank you.
Okay, next we're going to call up Glenn Kolb and Dan Kohler.
Well, good afternoon, Chair Edwards, Vice Chair Olson, the committee members. My name is Glenn Kolb. I'm director with the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association. And our association participated in a work group to discuss the merits of what has become House Bill 2474. And we're in agreement with the intent and also the legislation as written. We understand and do recognize the licensing board's need and importance to have oversight of facilities, and we support that. The engrossed version of the bill does require the board to convene a rules advisory committee. We also support that. Actually, we introduced that amendment on the House side. There are more than 525 practices in the state, and as the largest group of stakeholders that would be affected by the bill, it's important that veterinarians have that representation, and that does occur within this bill. There also are other stakeholders as designated in this. They also have representation, and we think that's important. As Lori had mentioned, the issue of ownership, I guess, you know, we will look at it, is the state more concerned about who owns as opposed to our standards of care being met? And you know, I have one example. There's of a non-veterinarian who's interested in buying his father's practice. He's been running the business as the hospital manager, practice manager for 20 plus years. He would like to purchase his father's practice. His father would like to sell the business to him. Currently, that does not exist. The law doesn't allow that. So we would like to see House Bill 2474 move forward and would appreciate your consideration.
All right, thank you. Go ahead.
Good morning, Senator Edwards and the rest of the group. My name is Dan Kohler. I'm a veterinarian and a licensed California attorney. I am the founder of Companion Pet Clinics. I built around 17 hospitals and sold most of them, and they've resold. And this bill affects us tremendously. It affects all the veterinarians in getting loans or having various animal hospitals buy hospitals from retiring veterinarians and or other veterinarians trying to get retirement income from it. And this bill will allow the banks to loan money to non-veterinarians to buy hospitals. Otherwise, banks don't do that. They look at the requirement. If they don't have a licensed veterinarian sitting in front of them, they're not going to loan them money. And it's a very sensitive thing. Even though, like Lori said, there is a continuation of a violation of the Practice Act with non-veterinary owners. And one in particular, there was a doctor, he owned one of my practices, Dr. Parinder Nagra, was killed in a car accident in 1999, January. And he left a wife and a child. And she had been running the practice and needed to continue to run the practice so that she could sell it. But fortunately, there was no cease and desist order from the board. But in California, they used to do that until they had a premise license issue. And what's important about the premise license and what this registration offers is a veterinarian that's responsible, that's licensed for the facility. The veterinarian who practices in that facility may be totally different, but he's responsible to the public through the board and is overseen by the board to practice within the standards. So that's not a problem when non-vets own practices. The problem was the ownership. And I think this bill is right on point and does everything that is required and will give the security not only to the non-owners, not being worried about a cease and desist order, it'll allow the continuation of high-quality practices being developed by companies like VCA, Veterinary Corporations of America, Banfield, and the like. And I think it should be voted on and passed.
I have questions for either one of you. And it was the testimony that got me to thinking about this. So you mentioned, Mr. Kohler, you mentioned the word high-quality practices right there, the words high-quality practices right there at the end. And what I'm wondering is, could you tell us a little bit about, in your industry, how standards of care are developed and maintained? And if say, you had, you know, completely speculatively, but yeah, you had somebody that is a less scrupulous individual, and they're not a veterinarian themselves, they don't have a veterinary license, but they see an opportunity, and I have no idea how they would know about that opportunity, but you know, they to have clinics that really push certain, I don't know, procedures or practices or sell certain products or something like that, and it's kind of on the edge of what is good for animal health, and they're under pressure because, or the licensed vet that works there and manages the facility works for the owner, and you know, they've, I mean, I'm just
under,
I'm trying to understand a little bit more about how consumer protection, what is the framework for consumer protection, and if the board wants to come back forward and explain this a little bit, that I'd appreciate that perspective.
Senator Edwards, I can tell you that the it makes no difference who owns the clinic. And if he wants something done below the standard of practice that is in the Practice Act, the veterinarian that is licensed is beholden to the veterinary board. In other words, the veterinary board regulates that veterinarian. And if, let's say I'm the owner and I say, oh, I don't want anyone wasting gloves, you got to use surgery gloves, two, three surgeries, and just wash them, it'll be okay. That veterinarian has to say no. He has to say, no, I'm not going to do it, or and if you're going to let me go, it's fine. I have to find another position where I can practice to the standards of practice within the community. So if he does perform like that, then he or she is in violation of the Practice Act and should be disciplined by the board. It can be done. I'm certain that there will be issues developing in time, but the veterinarian controls because of the license. And that's a way of controlling the level of practice and of the facility. A lot of facilities today are below standard because they haven't been brought up to standard for various reasons. And sometimes it's a good thing to sell and have the new owner come in and develop the practice.
Please.
Chair Edwards, I would only add that I think you had asked earlier how the standards are set. The board establishes minimum standards.
If you could say your name again for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. Lori Mockinen with the Veterinary Board. We have minimum standards that are a minimum standard is one that maintains animal and public health and safety, but may not be the very best quality of care. It still meets a minimum standard. So high quality of care is, you know, as long as the minimum standards are being met, then each practice can decide that they're going to add wine and chocolates to, right, you know, their services. And the board reviews the minimum standards both for medical practice and for facilities fairly frequently. It comes up at board meetings whether or not we need to look at the rules and change. And some of these minimum standards are really basic things like air quality, potable water, storage, drugs are stored properly and things like that. And again, they're minimum standards, but the board believes that an animal who is being treated in Klamath Falls should have the same minimum safety and protection medical standards that an animal being treated in Portland. And so those are their state, it's a statewide standard.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you for that clarification and the background. Questions for the panelists? Okay. Don't see any other questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else that would like to testify on House Bill 2474A? Nobody else signed up. Okay, seeing none, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2474A. That concludes the posted agenda, so we are adjourned. Posted agenda, so we are adjourned.